Okay, so hi everyone. We kind of decided to restart our colloquia in this interesting format. And I've kind of volunteered to do the first talk. Let me see. I have to hide your thumbnails so I can see my talk fully. I'll talk about the type 2 subanalytic quantum dots, basically the work I've done with a lot of collaborators over the maybe last 14, 15 years. So, but mostly I'll focus on two aspects, which I will call material sciences. It's how it took us a long time to we kind of had the idea what and how the dots look and what they are, but to prove it, it's very, very hard. So we spend a lot of time and a lot of effort to understand the structure of the submonolaric quantum dots. I'll talk a little bit of two quick examples about fundamental physics we've done to that, and talk about our latest efforts to use the same structure we studied fundamental physics for application, and particularly in the solar cells. So I listed major institutions that would participate in this work and the funding over the years that supported this work. So this is a list of people. You see a lot of people working with me in the group of over the years. The first work actually on Aronov bomb effect, which I'll mention later, was done with Weldon. Then until recently, we have now our Leah working with us, and Pipat from master's program working with us. Over the year, I worked with collaborators from Queen's College, especially in theory, both labs, and Vladimir and Fred, of course, helped us with magnets for a long time. And a special hi goes to group of Maria Camargo. Unfortunately, she just sent email, she cannot join us, and especially recently for Vasilis, who is on a talk. So if I need some questions on the growth that you have specific, he can help me. He grew recent material for solar cells very successfully. Milan, who also joined us from ASRC, who was instrumental in finally us making actual devices, and I'll mention it, it's not that easy. Group of Seth Noyan over the years helped us with the X-ray, and Smirnov's group at High Magnetic Field Laboratory with magneto optics, and some other people listed here who participated and contributed to the work over the years. So that's the quick outline which I kind of mentioned already. And so I will go first. I'll discuss what is the band two type two band alignment. So if you look at the semiconductor structure, heterostructure, you have to cannot look just at the band gap of a material. You have to look at the band gap alignment, and actually the bottom of the conduction band and the top of the valence band alignment of two systems. So if you particularly look at the quantum dots or quantum wells, then you have kind of three types, which are listed only two here. Type one, it's just the jargon, is when it's shown here, when electron or hole both confined to the quantum dot or quantum well. In the type two is only one of the carriers confined to the quantum dot or quantum well, and another carrier is actually located in the barrier. So what happens in this case that the carriers are spatially separated. The key that they interact only in the real space. In the direct band gap semiconductor that we're working right now with, they're still direct in the K space. So in effect, you don't need a phonon-assisted recombination. Yes, matrix element overlap for the recombination oscillator strength is substantially reduced, but you don't need phonons for recombination assistance. So one of the couple of things I'll mention later on, but mention here too, that the strong blue shift of luminescence with the intrinsic excitation and decrease, I will describe later on how and why that happens. Relatively long radiative recombination time, and that's clear because overlap elements are small, matrix elements are small, and because of that, also small electron hole binding energy. And it's kind of a cartoon how we imagine it at the beginning, but we'll see that it's really how it has to be shifted to that. The system we're working with is in the form B, and that's in this case, in our case, holes are confining the quantum dots rather than the electrons. I will have to apologize for a second. I have to do something. Give me 1 2 minutes. I'm sorry, I had to open the door. So let's look what happens when you have ideal type two cylindrical quantum dot, which is actually our system. So it's interesting that if it's a cylindrical, let's say kind of pancake quantum dot, that if the hole is confined to the quantum dot, that electrons will sit on the top and the bottom of the quantum dot, and it's shown here. So the electrical dipole will be in the direction of the growth direction. So that will be important later on for understanding how we need to make the system available for, let's say, for some of the fundamental studies we've done. So you need to do something with that to push electrons away from the top on the bottom. So that what happens when you do optical excitation, so specifically photoluminescence. So if you pump photo-generated carriers, and generally we pump them above the larger material band gap, above the band gap, so you create electron hole pairs. And because they're spatially separated, you can think about a formation of the n-type sheet on one side and the p-type sheet on the other side. So basically you're forming the capacitor or electric field across the interface. So you can think about that, interestingly, as a kind of p-n junction. So which will lead to the band bending. So this band bending generally creates potential well for the carrier in the barrier, and in this case, the electron is even more so. And if your dots are large of a quantum well, you can calculate and show that the higher you pump, the Fermi level in this triangular potential well will move up approximately the cubic root of excitation intensity. It's not always follows that. And actually we did the numerical work with, Niemeyer-Schweif, and later I'll give the reference when we calculated it's numerically, so we know how that happens. What is interesting so that if you pump stronger, you create more carriers, and you move the level up, and you have a blue shift, which is basically a hallmark of type two. That's how we always check if we have type two structure or not. So in a lifetime, because you have again, small overlap of electron hole wave functions, you have time resolve, in the time resolve photoluminescence long-lived carriers. But what is interesting is the lifetime is now dependent on the carrier concentration, because the overlap depends on the carrier concentration. Because the harder you pump, the higher energy of the electron, the wave function penetrates more, and you have stronger recombination, so a faster decay. So that's also another mark of this. So basically, here's a strong excitation, more photo-generated carriers, stronger band bending, narrow potential will increase overlap of the wave function. So that's the key. A couple of examples. So the calculation was done by in this work, and it's just an example from one of the papers. We've done it for multiple times. So you can see that the emission is quite complicated in our case, but if you carefully decompose it in possible transitions, which you can guess and get from the experience, you can see that this one is not quantum dot related. It's barely shifts with excitation intensity, but these two are, and they have a pretty good cubic root dependence. So this is the lifetime. So we've measured it at different excitation intensities. This is the black curve is calculated in this paper. It's actually also established condition for what we call flat band condition, where there is no band bending, and you can see the decay, how fast it moves, depends on excitation intensity, and you can actually overlay this in one curve, because obviously if you pump harder, it's faster, but then if recombination carriers reduce concentration of carriers, and you, it should match at some point your pumping intensity, so these three curves fall together. So that's kind of discussion of major types of type 2 structures and quantum dots in particular. So you, because we have one carrier is trapped and one carrier is kind of free, only attracted by Coulomb interaction, it sometimes mimic what people develop for isoelectronic traps. So when we did the lifetime measurements as a function of temperature, tried to measure excitonic binding energy, we discovered that lifetime is actually increased first with temperature rather than decrease. And that we explain is by this ionization recapture process. When the when you increase the temperature, because let's say in our case, Hall is strongly confined with the quantum dot, the first you have the electron ionized because the binding energy is small. We didn't know at the time, but we expect it to be small due to type 2 nature. And then until this hole can thermalize from the quantum dot, the electron can come back and recombine. So that's increase your lifetime. So using this process and the formula from one of these papers in 60s, I like papers in 60s, you'll see. They done a lot of work, which people forget. So you can use this application, this expression basically, which calculates radiative lifetime as a function of temperature, include non-radiative lifetime. You can do the fitting of the curves and you can estimate different. So you can see that exciton binding energy is fairly small, and small because even in zinc telluride, which is smallest, it's about 13 millielectron volts, but zinc selenide is close to 25 millielectron volts. And the binding energy of holes is also in about 100 millielectron volts, which probably it's kind of not exactly makes sense, but it shows that it's fairly strongly confined in the quantum well. And it's an example of one of the work we've done not so far along. So having established general rules of type 2 quantum dots, I'd like to point out that we work with the 2-6 semiconductor systems. So this is one of the plots we're looking at. That's a general plot of energy band gap versus lattice constants. I'll show you it multiple times, we'll see it. So because most of the samples, almost all samples we've done are grown on either on gallium arsenide, because it relates to zinc selenide, on the indium phosphide, which relates to zinc cadmium selenide. And that's the approximate band alignments at room temperature. So you can see that zinc selenide, zinc telluride is fairly good type 2 structure. Cadmium telluride with cad selenide, fairly good type 2 structure. And these are major structures we're working. Over the years, we learned how to grow multiple layers, up to 300 layers. And we know how to dope the system. So if we need to do the doping for practical applications, we can. So that's a regional growth sequence. So you can see it's not a simple growth procedure. So it's grown by molecular beam epitaxy, which I'll show you next. But basically, first you grow the barrier, where the open, it means shutters open. I'll show you shutters in a second. And then you have a region where you grow quantum dots. So you have shutters open, close. So basically you alternate elements instead of send them together, which allows you more surface diffusion. And it's an interesting process of formation of quantum dots, which is different from general people grow strain-driven quantum dots when they grow layer, which builds the strain and it breaks. So basically, so-called type one, most of the quantum dots in 3-5 system, and most of even 2-6 are grown by these methods, so-called Stransky-Krasnov methods. And it's actually, if you think about it, those quantum dots are defect-free defects themselves. So it's this interesting view. So here's the example of schematics of MBE. So you can see you have to close and open these shutters. and it's not that simple. You have to have a good skill. And of course, in Maria's group, they're one of the best in the world with the 2-6 systems. And even that's not simple. This is the image of their lab. So you have 3-5 chamber, 2-6 chamber, all the tracks loading. So I only seen it. I never touched it. It's very complicated, but it's fascinating things to do. So now we grow this multi-layer structure. So how we look at it. So this is an example of one of the samples we grew with the zinc magnesium telluride. So you can see in the TEM fairly well layered structure here. Magnesium helped us with the contrast layer. Then we've done X-ray diffraction, was pretty good, high quality. You can see super lattice peaks up to the fifth order. And you can use this data to simulate this X-ray. And it allows you to obtain certain important information about the material structure. So in this particular case, we found out, and it's most of the cases, we have some other materials, obviously, I'm not going to show all the curves, that a tellurium, because we grew zinc telluride-driven quantum dots, the tellurium only minimal amount is in the spacer regions. So in the barriers, it's only 1% or less than 1%. Actually, there is interesting, this 1% has also interesting properties, which we studied, and I'm not going to talk about this, but for purpose of quantum dot formation, it's interesting that most of the tellurium is actually stays within the quantum dots. In this particular case, we managed to estimate that we have about 32% magnesium in those quantum dots. So that's another example of X-ray for our major material systems, zinc telluride, zinc selenide. So you can see also the quality is very high. And we managed to go to Brookhaven from all this major reflection or chemical sensitive reflection and see super lattice peaks. So how the tellurium is disposed, this work done in was done in Albany. So again, you can see some sort of periodic structure. And this is a chemical analysis. So you can see that tellurium is mostly located into this small periods and it's not continuous. So that's the kind of cross-section work. So how do you see from the top? And I said this was done over the years. This was, I think, was about only 3 or 4 years back. So that's interesting piece of work done in Brookhaven National Laboratory by Hanfeis, the former student of Noyan. What he did, they have now ability in Brookhaven to focus.
Is it okay asking your questions while you're talking?
Say, slide? You don't see the slide?
No. Can I ask you a question?
Ah, sure.
So you said that the super lattice or is formed by tellurium atoms or by what?
Yeah, by mostly by zinc telluride.
Okay, but on this slide you showed that they're not very periodic, right?
It's an increased contrast. I can go into detail. It's increased contrast. So this is, if you take the lines, they're fairly periodic. And you know from the X-ray super lattice up to the fifth order, these samples, I think we get up to the third order. Yes, it's a rough surface. So because you grow quantum dots and the quantum dots, even though sub-monolayer, we believe they're quantum dots. If you had the quantum well, then it will be continuous. And that's the whole point I'm trying to make, that we don't have a quantum well, we have a quantum dot. And of course, this is enhanced contrast. It's a lot of work goes into just see that tellurium. We spent, that's what my point is, we spent so much time to even see the tellurium. We actually have never seen pure quantum dots themselves. And for many years, it was a problem until people in 3-5 community finally start growing also submonolayer quantum dots, even they could not see them. So we kind of, okay, you have to look at this kind of extra evidence to make the conclusions.
Yeah, my question actually is, on the previous slide, you showed like X-ray picture, which was very yes. sharp peak. Very sharp.
Very sharp, peak. Yes. It's
it because that the structure is extremely good.
Yes, because this is a very, look, you work with, it's an issue of experimental sensitivity. This is, it's a TMM chemical analysis, so you cannot really get that well. And as I said, an enhanced image. So they had to work at this. So I wouldn't believe exactly each feature here. X-ray is much more sensitive to the contrast of the electronic density of the atomic structure. So if you have a lot of tellurium in the barrier, in the quantum dust versus the barrier, X-ray will clearly see that. But the TEM imaging will not. TEM electron diffraction will, and I'll show you, but not the imaging. So okay. That's what I'm going. This one is also not perfect. It's, think about it. They try to focus X-ray beam.
This one I completely do not understand.
Let me explain to you. So this is the big square. It's the X-ray goes under the angle. So they have an aspect ratio. And this rectangular image is actually scale. So this size are not the same. So now here they're the same. So the red is actually amount of tellurium they see in fluorescence. It's also very difficult to do because you think about you focus X-ray beam to the about a 10 nanometer spot. And then they go, I forgot to put the size. I think it's a few hundred nanometers scan. So the point I'm trying to make that if I had tellurium spread all over the material, let's say it's a quantum well, then you will see more or less uniform intensity of tellurium emission fluorescence. You bombard it with the X-ray and then look at fluorescence of the spot. But it's not. So the point is that we don't have uniform distribution of tellurium in our system. That means we have chunks of them in plane. So we do have quantum dust. They're not perfectly nice. And of course, that's again, it's the imaging and enhanced contrast. But it's a qualitative picture. It's not quantitative picture. Qualitative picture in a point that I don't have uniform distribution of tellurium. I have only patches. So we know that we have patches of quantum dust. And thinking that we're going, this is a type top view. So if I have multi-layer structure, that means we have to have a columns of this quantum dust. So having said that, the next step, we'll look into that. So then you go into the X-ray diffraction again, and you can do so-called reciprocal space mapping. It's basically you can look how much is you deviate from your Bragg reflection. That's as much as I want to take right now. So, and you plot this deviation in the Z direction, that's mean in the Gross direction where the X-ray comes, to the in-plane deviation. And there is a very well-developed theories that shows that if you look at this plot, and if you have elongation of this distortion, I know it's hard to understand from the quick talk, it has to be whole talk by itself, but just let's assume you believe me and you can read the papers. So if you have a distortion along the in-plane direction, that means you have a stacking of the dots in the Z direction and vice versa. If you have elongation in the Z direction, then you have arrangements of the dots in an in-plane. So we clearly saw the elongation along the QX direction, which shows that we do have a stacking of the dots in a vertical direction. More than that, it was possible to apply the theory of the stacking and strain-driven stacking by plotting half width of half maximum at these elongated reflections and feed that and get how much is actually this sigma. It's a captures vertical alignment in a Gaussian approximation. So if you do that, you can pretty much well fit the data we have. And we saw that the larger the dots will grow, the more vertical correlations you have. So that was the kind of first evidence that we do have stacking. We I'm going this way. Let me mention it. When we started the work, we did actually first start on a bomb when we knew we had stacking. I'll mention it later on, but we never could actually prove it. So this was the first proof that we do have stacking. And this luminescence data shows that you not only have a stacking, you have actually overlap of the wave function of the holes between the dots. So they form a mini band. So before we showed that if you have a larger vertical correlation, you have a larger overlap of the wave function. So you form a mini band. So your lifetime has to be faster. And we did show that. So that was kind of the first evidence that we do have a formation of the stacks. And not only that, that quantum dot, the holes in the quantum dots do talk to each other and do form mini band, which was interesting that we assumed that when we did the calculation before with Vladimir, but we didn't know that at that time. We kind of guessed that, and that's later on we actually did prove that. So then what is the in-plane thing? So then you go more into detail, and this was work done by Vexillary, and he did, unfortunately he didn't finish it. He left Colombia right away to France. So, but he did very interesting work. So what he did, that was the experimental measurement of this X-ray diffraction, and he looked at different directions, specific directions in this peak, and he modeled diffused scattering. And I, that's a little bit different than the actual peak. It's loose how much scattering happens, not in terms of interference, but it's a diffuse scattering, random scattering. And he could model it point by point. So basically he took zinc atom, scatter X-rays, took tellurium atom, scatter X-ray, took selenium atom, scatter X-ray, and sum it all together. So he did the modeling based on our growth modeling, and that's what he got. So he looked at that, what happens, and he did also saw the correlation, it's a so-called fishbone I'm not showing. So we know that even these samples are correlated vertically. We can show that. But what's interesting, what happens in plane. So he did this complete modeling. What he discovered that if you have quantum dots of different size, randomly oriented, you will see a spherical diffuse model. You should see the spherical diffuse image. If you have either randomly distributed shapes, you also see almost spherical, and it's in specific direction, which we didn't see. But if and only if you have elongated quantum dots along 110 direction in 001 plane, then you will pretty much fit what you see in experiment. And then we did polarized, linearly polarized photoluminescence of these quantum dots, and we exactly saw the same behavior, polarization along the same direction, complementing the X-ray diffraction. So the our model is the following. So our quantum dots are pancakes, but not purely spherical. They elongated, and we know we calculated from the luminescence for what's the degree of elongation. They elongated all along 110 direction. So that's the actually model we are working with right now in most of the our quantum dots. If we need to, in a simple approximation, we take this just a cylindrical quantum dot stack and more or less randomly distribute it in plane, but elongated in a given direction. So that's kind of a material science part of the work, which took actually about 10 years to.
Igor, can I ask one question?
Sure.
Can you give me maybe some sort of intuitive understanding why the PL and the X-ray signals are completely out of phase?
I don't remember right now, honestly. It's just that I can't answer it right now. Okay. I have to look at the X. I know what happens in the luminescence, but I have to look at the X-ray. So I have to look at the X-ray, how the X-ray, where this actually delta QX is, because I know this 90 degrees is along this direction. So I have to look at the X-ray that I'm not ready to answer. I have to look at the X-ray data because I not as well with the X-ray as with the luminescence.
Okay.
So that's the kind of our model. And then one more point I have to make, that working with the magneto optics, and we have actually diamagnetic shift data, which we never published because they came later on. And we work on the model with how G did the old calculation. So the proper way to look at this is that we have a stack dots elongated, but the hole is not in the center of quantum dot. It's actually tight binding situation where the hole and electron are closely tied together and actually move as a one around the dot if we apply magnetic field. So couple of examples. Oh, that's the X-ray. So it's interesting historical point I was trying to make. We actually done special sample back in 2006 and done TEM analysis in the Brookhaven National Laboratory with Slava Volkov. So, and he did E-beam diffraction, and we kind of used this to calculate the period, but we never really spent too much time on that. But we already, if you look back, historically we missed that. So if you look back, the same, he saw 002 reflection. It's an E-beam diffraction. It's the same as an X-ray diffraction in essence. He saw the satellites, elongated satellites. So that's already showed us, which you missed at the time, that the quantum dots are stacked, vertically stacked. And if at the time we would have should have done the analysis, we probably could have find out if we have a specific direction of elongation. And because sample was specifically grown with a lot of tellurium, we have this image, and if you believe it, and now all many years looking at this, I do believe that that would be probably the image of looking stacking of quantum dots pretty well, columns you can see. But this is the specific sample was grown with what I would say 30 seconds tellurium. It has a lot of tellurium. So we never studied the sample for any other application than the this TEM. So that's the to Alex's point. If you see this, and I think that's probably the best image we ever had, which we kind of should have emphasized more, but over there. It's kind of a lesson, I guess. So a couple of examples of fundamental physics work. So first, I'll point out, we looked at the G factor. So we did polarized photoluminescence up to 18 Tesla. And it was interesting combination here that we saw that emission, which has higher energy, is actually has higher intensity, which you would not expect with a normal Boltzmann distribution. So with, because I want to go back to, I want to go more to the quantum solar cells. So I'm not going to go in details how we did the analysis, the papers published. We've done a lot of work on this, how to prove that it's what it is. Back and forth with reviewers. It's very detailed step by step why that's the right model. And if you use that, you do the measurement. We did measurement from 0.36 Kelvin to about 30 Kelvin. Actually, the G factor, you have to go to higher temperatures. So when we calculate the G factor for the exciton is 1.65 plus minus 0.3. And if you apply what we know about G factor of electron in selenite, you can calculate G factor of the heavy hole, which is the ground state of the zinc telluride quantum dots. And we obtained 1.65 2.75 plus minus 0.4 for the G factor of the heavy hole. Then if you take the bulk value of zinc telluride heavy hole, it's only 0.85. So the interesting question why was enhancement. It's well known that the G factor is usually enhanced in quantum dots due to the confinement, but we wanted to know what's the major mechanism, and it also gives you information of the size of the quantum dots. That was interesting for us too at the time, because as you know, we struggle to actually see our quantum dots. So we went talked to Garnett Bryan from NIST, and he did very detailed tight binding calculations. And as not unexpected, the major contribution was then because you take the quantum dots and it's a small quantum dots, you suppress orbital contribution, which is a negative diamagnetic contribution to the G factor. And that's the major contribution to increase of the G factor of the hole in the quantum dot. But what was interesting, he did the modeling versus the number of tellurium layers. That's what his terminology, but basically it's a monolayer. It's a half of the lattice parameter, how many zinc telluride layers we have. And what is the radius of the quantum dot? So it turns out to match our experimental observation, most of the samples have to be only one monolayer thick. So it's very, very hard to see in any imaging. That's why we never could see it. At most, you can have two monolayers, and if the quantum dots at about 10 nanometer radius. And even here, that's what 10. And it's actually our diamagnetic data, which I don't show here, show that we have about 9 nanometer of radius for the electron hole pair, which should be kind of matching with the size of the quantum dots. So now, using this data and everything I showed before, the model is that most of our quantum dots elongated. The size between 10 to 20 nanometer radius, which is not that small. So we can use quantum well theories if we need to calculate energy of the hole level. But the thickness of these dots, it's no more than two monolayers. So it's no more than one lattice parameter thick. We probably never ever have any quantum dot which is thicker than two monolayers. But most of the time, it's one monolayer thick. So that's the part which is fundamental physics gave us material science information. So obviously, I can't, there is a details a little bit. So I cannot skip our work on Aronov-Bohm effect. Just remind you that in classical electrodynamics, vector potential is considered mathematical convenience in calculations. But of course, in quantum mechanics, we know that it has a physical meaning. So in 1959, Aronov-Bohm first showed that, but actually optically the final proof, even though there was a work in the transport, kind of final proof, I think everybody more or less accepted that, was done only in 2007. So two things different from transport. One thing is extra appears in the optical emission versus transport measurements. When you have energy oscillation, which translates in transport to the oscillation of the resistivity or resistance, that's kind of understandable from this formula. However, in optics, there is another property, which is when exciton moves from the non-zero orbital momentum due to the flux contribution, that changes the selection rules for the emission. So you can show that in a dipole approximation, only exciton with the total orbital momentum zero will have strong emission. So that means you should see this basically only also peaks in emission intensity, which is have not been seen before we did the work. So actually, oscillation in energy was shown in 2004 in indium phosphide gallium arsenide quantum dots, but it's interesting that its work is not very reproducible. And it turns out it took a few years. By 2007, people understood when you grow quantum dots by Stronsky-Krasnov method, it's actually not controllable. And it depends how you grow quantum dots. Sometimes you have carriers on the top or the bottom of the quantum dot, as I mentioned before, and you don't have Aronov-Bohm effect. But sometimes you have them on the sides and you do. So our system was very convenient to do this experiments because we had the stack structure. So if you have one quantum dot, as you remember, the electron will sit on the top of the bottom quantum dot and you will not have the effect. However, if you build the super lattice of these quantum dots, the electron wave function will be pushed to the side and you can have Aronov-Bohm effect. More than that, you're basically averaging that size distribution of the quantum dots, because electron is actually rotates around the whole stack. So that's actually what happens. And that's one of the best representation of what we saw. This is our Arrondo Bone Peak. We've done a lot of work to measure and understand them. We showed that in the void configuration, you don't have the peak. So it's kind of a good evidence that that's what happens. This one, we also, we looked at polarized luminescence, and it turns out we have a lot of background emission. Obviously our system is very complicated and dirty, but if you have it, if you look at the circularly polarized luminescence, you can actually suppress, as you saw from the work on G-factor, you can suppress some of the emission, and you can actually see this peak was probably the largest ever reported, about 15% oscillation. It's pretty strong. So we actually, for a long time, could not see energy oscillation, but then very carefully, again, in the polarized luminescence, because you suppress background oscillation, you can see this small wiggle, which corresponds to the transition magnetic field of intensity. So we did see oscillation in energy also in our samples. So that's the fundamental, kind of very quick things you can do with this material system studying fundamental physics. So another piece of work we've done is with Lev Murak, that we looked at quantum decoherence. So we were surprised that if you have Arrondo Bone Peak, which is, you need a coherence effect, it survives about 31 Kelvin. So it's very, very high temperature. So that's the kind of, you can see purely 27 and 31 is not as great, but you can actually do see. What's important that we found out that overall intensity of the luminescence increases. We actually don't have a good explanation for that why. We have some explanation, but we're not sure why. But Arrondo peak intensity decreases. So we know that the decrease of Arrondo Bone Peak is not due to overall temperature quenching of luminescence, which is, was interesting and good for us. So that's the actual percent visibility peak as a function of temperature. That deep, we don't know what it is. It's might be instrumental because that's very close to 1.7 Kelvin where the leak helium 3 kicks in. But we have no, we don't have a good proof of that yet. So when you look at the decoherence of excitons, the major approach was developed by Bori in 2005 and is due to the so-called independent boson model. Basically, it's a allophono scattering. So we did this modeling and it turns out you can fit our data, but you need energy of this activation, energy of phonons, only about 2 to 7 millielectron volts. But the phonon energy for the zinc selenide and zinc telluride is much higher than that. Plus, without going into details, you had to take this alpha to zero, which is also was problematic. So we came up with a hybrid model of decoherence. So first we say that only electrons are scattered since they're being in the barriers and the holes are confined in the quantum dots, so they don't scatter. Because the electrons in the barriers, they will scatter as the transport electrons do. And the major thing is that the scattering has to be proportional to the linear function of temperature due to the electron-electron interaction or fluctuation averaging. And you have to have a contribution to the electron-phonon interaction. So, but the matrix element due to electron phonon acoustic scattering is suppressed because you have a Coulomb interaction between electron and hole. And it is interesting that the similar thing, and it was calculation actually done by Peter Kwok in 1966, and actually Philip Stanislavskog, he has to leave physics for, I was told recently, physics. He was working at IBM to run family business, so too bad. So he had the idea in 1966, and it actually similar to what we were thinking. So using this model, we actually managed to fit our data pretty well. and we could extract this scattering parameter and calculate it using our lifetime data, assuming that electron makes the full rotation around quantum dot. And we calculated this, our parameter was much smaller, two orders of magnitude smaller than the one you will calculate for zinc selenide using the standard model. So basically it tells you that you can study decoherence, quantum decoherence using type two quantum dots. So now last 15 minutes, I think I'll go in the photovoltaics. So we had an idea that use these materials for photovoltaics. I'll explain in a second, but just remind you what's the problems, kind of, not problems, but the issues with the quantum dots. So if you take perfectly ideal p-n junction, single junction quantum dot, you have so-called Shockley quasar limit developed in 1961, and then actually updated in 1994, but Arai and Marty to the full concentration. That's when you take sun, pull the optics and concentrated in the quantum dot, so you can increase in efficiency. So if you do that, if you have a perfectly fine ideal quantum dot, you can only get efficiency more than 30%, and under solar concentration, no more than 41%. So that's why the modules right now about the best quantum dots, I think gallium arsenide in laboratory close to 26% now, and it's silicon because not as good, I think 23, and the modules go close to 20%. So basically right now, single junction solar cells commercially already very close to ideal values. So a couple of things people suggest to do to improve that. One is in multi-junction solar cells. They're also right now in production, but they're very expensive. They actually use them in the solar, in the space applications, and you can get efficiency under solar concentration right now, record, I think, close to 46-47%. So they complicated structures you can see here, but that's probably out of the what they call third generation solar cells, the one in the practical applications. Another one been discussed for many years, multi-carrier generation colloidal nanocrystals, even was an attempt that it was shown about a few years back. You can kind of improve if you combine it with the standard solar cells, not much of the success. And the third one, which is kind of in between, there is certain successes people showed, but I don't think any practical production ever yet happened, is so-called intermediate band gap solar cell. That's the one we're trying to work with. So what's the idea? In a nutshell, idea is the following. So you create an extra levels in the mid gap of your material. So you can, instead of just absorption from valence band to conduction band, you can have a two-step absorption. It's not two photon step, it's a linear process, it's a real absorption. So that's why we use two-step absorption. So you absorb first electron into the intermediate band, and then from intermediate band into the conduction band. And you can calculate, and this was original work, 1997 proposal, and it took many, many years before actual even model was demonstrated that it's possible to do. So you can achieve solar concentration up to 63% of the full solar concentration in these ranges. And I actually added this arrow to show that you actually can relax your requirement if you really want to achieve practicality, because working with this, we noticed that to match 0.7 and exactly one, basically it's a 2 electron volts band gap is very, very hard. But if you work within this range and you have much more leeway, okay, you're working, you don't get 63%, you can get 60% if you can. Then it would be very well, still very good. So, because working with this material, you find out that it's very, very hard to match it perfectly. So most of the work is usually was done with the 3-phase materials, but why our 2-6 submonolayer quantum dots? So first, in 3-5 materials, if you notice, the band gap is much smaller. They're very good for single junction solar cells. But for intermediate band solar cells, you need 2 electron volts of high or very close to 2 electron volt band gap material. In most of the 3-5 materials of the ones which are used in industry are not suitable. Maybe only aluminum gallium arsenide is. So it turns out that our 2-6 system is perfectly suited by numbers at least for this application. Second of all, they grow most of their quantum dust by Stronsky-Krasnov. So they have wetting layer, which is a quantum well, and you can show in details that if you have a quantum well, it actually allows easy escape of decayers from the quantum dust. And second of all, because it's a strain driven, you cannot grow too many layers, usually about 10 to 15 layers. We can grow 300. And doping, they have to dope their quantum dust, right? You have to create levels in intermediate band. So they have to dope into the bare pairs to provide energy, the electrons of holes into the quantum dust. We can dope directly. We've done that already by that time. So that's the solution we suppose. And because our quantum dust is sub-monolayer, we expect it not to have a wetting layer. We don't have a wetting layer, but I'll show you the problem we encountered. So that's things, ideas is one thing, but the implementation is something else. So what are the materials? I go back to this image, this kind of cartoon. So it turns out if you grow zinc cadmium selenide with about 2.1 electron volt band gap, it would be lattice matched to indium phosphide, which is great. It turns out that if you have a look at the band offset for zinc cadmium selenide with a zinc selenium telluride kind of system, your band offset will be about 1 electron volt, which should allow you to create 0.7 electron volt intermediate band out of the holes. Again, we can grow very thick layers and we can dope them directly. So that was a perfect thing to do. And we started it doing it about 6 or 7 years ago, and it's a long time. So the first, so that's kind of a proposed model, and that's what we actually working with. So you have a quantum dust for absorption, you have zinc cadmium selenide for n-type layer. We cannot make, unfortunately, zinc cadmium selenide p-type layer, which is detrimental in our case, and I'll show you why later on because of the open circuit voltage. But that's what the structure we're working with now. So obviously, okay, we know how to grow these things. So instead of zinc selenide, we just do zinc cadmium selenide, and that's you expect the structure. You make your solar cells and everything works fine. It didn't. So it turns out when we grew the system, we had pretty high quality system, and we grew zinc cadmium selenide lattice matched indium phosphide. What we were struck that super lattice was on this side of the peak. For those who don't know, without going into detail, it means that you have a tensile strain in the system. And we were puzzled why you have a tensile strain in the system, because if you look at our materials, it's a zinc telluride, it's a cadmium selenide, it's a cadmium telluride, they all compressively strain to indium phosphide. And only zinc selenide, and only if you have zinc selenide, very almost pure zinc selenide, it will explain to that. So we had to conclude that we actually, instead of pure zinc telluride quantum dots, we have this interfacial zinc selenide layer, which is detrimental because you have to compensate for that. It can be cake for the carriers. So we kind of inadvertently created kind of a wetting layer. So we spent a lot of time finding how that happens. Started with Sittard and Vasilis kind of finished the work. So we discovered that basically desorption of the cadmium during the growth is responsible. So Vasilis recently, very recently work found out a new Charcot sequence. So basically, and I'm skimming a lot of work we've done to understand that, that you have to passivate your layer with the cadmium telluride and then shorten the time between shutter sequence to suppress cadmium telluride desorption. And even doing that, the best he could do is reduce the zinc selenide layer from 2 monolayer to about 0.75 monolayer. So we could not get rid of that. But then again, we were looking at this from the point of view of our fundamental physics work, and we started with zinc telluride and we get stuck in that. But then Vasilia said, okay, why are we even growing zinc telluride quantum dots? And Vasilia said, let's grow, why we don't we even need zinc there? Because if you look, yeah, that was the improvement. I'll skip on that. That's the detail. But if you look at this picture again, we don't really need zinc telluride. We can work purely with the cadmium telluride. If we have a zinc cadmium selenide, you can still make it tight too. And more than that, you will reduce your valence band offset, which is detrimental. You want to have it flat to reduce the scattering of the carriers. So again, because you have the habit, like with the tellurium, so we kind of took us time, but we realized that we need to grow cadmium telluride quantum dots. And that's what Vasilios did recently. So he grew pure cadmium telluride quantum dots using this new shutter sequence. And that's the beautiful X-ray diffraction. You have a quality is perfectly fine. You have compressive strain. You have almost lattice match a buffer indicator. And it's actually, we managed to calculate all the details, and Leah working with us right now, how to improve that and put it on computer. And we have the code so we can feedback to the growth. So Leah is working on how to analyze X-ray data right now to improve that. And so we did the calculations. So we knew that we have a submonolayer coverage. We can calculate it. So basically we have a coverage between 0.66 and 0.76, depending on the strain in the system. Using the model we developed with Cassandra, Gahan, and Lev Deitch, how to calculate energy levels. We calculated energy level at this dot is a 0.3 electron volts. It's still far from what we want to do, 0.7. But now thinking about that point I made, that we still have a leeway, we might be able to push it to about 0.5. I don't think we can push it to 0.7, but we'll try. So what's done, a lot of work to analyze these dots, and in actually luminescence, we saw where we expected to see the luminescence from our calculation. We did see type 2 behavior, so we do have type 2.1.
Over the photos rigging?
Say it again. What's the question? Okay. I want to a little bit go get to the actual solar cell. So I'll skip on the CR. It's important work done by Vasilios to show that the structure as it is. But now using this, can we grow quantum dots as samples, actually? Yes, we can. Vasilios, actually, Sukar grew the first one, I'll show you. But Vasilios grew the few now with the cadmium telluride quantum dots. You can see excellent lattice matching. Not all of them working perfectly, but this was one of the best samples. So you can see super lattice peak, buffer layer, all under the zinc indium phosphide, it's a lattice match. The only thing is that we get almost, didn't work out well with the top layer, p-top layer in this particular case, was mostly zinc selenide rather than zinc selenium telluride. So, did the etching through to achieve, to reach quantum dots, did the luminescence, did the intensity study. So we have it, indeed, we have cadmium telluride zinc selenide quantum dots active layer. We can dope it, so it's doped. So that's the device structure. But do we, can we make a device? And it turns out, I mean, when Sittard did the original work, he actually stayed 1 year longer to try to make a device. And it was very hard, we couldn't do it. So we could not do it because it's not easy. That's the original actually structure drawn by Start. We did some optical measurements that doping helps. So that's the SEM, similar to what is grown right now, but we don't have the SEM on the samples yet. So I show you this one. So it's a similar structure, but instead of zinc cadmium telluride, we have just your cadmium telluride quantum dots. And we had actually space beta sample. We'll try to make the device out of this sample. It's very hard to make. So that's where the ASRC with the and the Milan comes in. And actually, Kipat, who is a master student at Photonics program, spending a lot of time at ASRC, that's the schematic how to actually make device. To grow, characterize, and understand physics and material science is one thing. To make device is another thing. So it's very, very hard to do. It took them almost 7 or 8 months already to understand all the procedure, all the steps parameters of etching, deposition, create the mask. So we finally did the devices, and I call this slide results obtained few days before the lockdown. So we made a device, we start the measurements, and now we had the shutdown. So that's the final results. I two final slides I will show you. So first, that's the actually solar cell IV curve ever done with, by us. I'm very happy with that. It's a pretty decent solar cell. It has fill factor about 40%. The higher fill factor, the better. That's what you like to have. People do get about 70 to 80% fill factor in single junction solar cells. We see relatively low, we see relatively high current. It's not per centimeter square, we don't have the data yet, but we have a relatively low open circuit voltage as 0.3 electron volts. And the reason being I'm going here, because remind you, because of this band alignment, that's where the open circuit voltage happens. Instead of 2 volts, it's only 0.3 volts. So that's something we have to deal with. But what is interesting, we managed to do, look at the external quantum efficiency of the reference sample without quantum dots, just intrinsic p-n junction, and the quantum dots. We used continuous laser at ASRC, very quick. It's just a rough analysis. I don't think it's publishable in a sense, but it gives us qualitative idea that the reference samples don't have this absorption, and a sample with quantum dots does have it. So we have evidence similar to what we saw before that we do have enhanced absorption in the visible, so which is good. And the last data I show you that how about the infrared, because you're fighting for this infrared, little bit of infrared light. And again, this is very rough data. We have to repeat and improve that. So this is a reference sample. We're looking at the reference sample absorption of visible light when we chop the infrared light. So we shine the infrared light into the sample. And if you have extra absorption due to the infrared light, your intensity, and that's intensity of photoelectrical response, should increase. So we didn't see any increase, and the red is a smooth curve, in reference sample. And we see some evidence of increase in a certain spectral region in the quantum dust. And again, this is data obtained probably just before the shutdown. And of course, we don't have time to repeat this data and analyze that. But that's what I wanted to talk today about. And thank you. I'm not gonna do the summary, it's too much, but I open to few questions. I think I went 5 minutes longer than I wanted to. And thank you.
Thank you. So,
I hope you enjoyed the talk. I didn't see any faces, I had to minimize you, which is hard, but I think as a first step, I think it's good. So any questions, anyone?
Questions, people.
So what is the next step for you in getting more efficient solar cell?
Next step to show that we truly have intermediate bent. And and I think we'll be kind of there. Improve the processing because we had three samples which we can work with, two reference and one quantum dot. As I said, processing is very hard, and Milan and Pipatkin and Vasilis, they doing this, Leah is learning as well to do that, is not easy. So a lot of things here depends on the contact formation, on the doping. So that's the first things to do. The second thing is to improve our P-type layer in a sense to reduce the valence band. And we have an idea because we worked with the zinc magnesium telluride before, as I showed you, in terms of the quantum dots. And the reason was because at that time we worked in terms of P-type doping. So we wanted to reduce the level of the hole in the quantum. Well, now we want to have it higher. So we want to go pure cadmium telluride. But if we go zinc magnesium telluride in a P-type layer, we can reduce the valence band. Let me go here. So if I can push this lower, I will increase my open circuit voltage. So that's something fundamental we'll have to look on the material side. But first, we would like to improve our processing steps and show the, definitely that we have intermediate band. What I showed you is maybe make us happy because we see progress, but we're not there yet. Milan will disagree, but I'm of course of his.
Igor, you mentioned where that small VOC might be coming from by pointing to the diagram. Can you go over that a little bit again?
Yeah, I can actually, if I go to this diagram, I should have put it that one. It's easier to see. Let me go find this diagram. So this diagram is much, so you can see here that open circuit voltage is between a Fermi level in the n-type layer and in a p-type layer. So Fermi level in the doping is between acceptor level and the valence band. So that's for our purposes. And if you take even an acceptor level 100 million electron volts, so Fermi level close to 100 million electron volts or less from the valence band. So for all practical purposes, you can take it at the valence band because we don't know precise. The same thing is here. So that means your open circuit voltage cannot be larger than the difference between conduction band in an n-type layer and the valence band in a p-type layer. And in this case, it's become, if you calculate, I think it would be very close to what we measure between 0.3 to 0.5 electron volts. Make sense?
Okay.
I hope. Anyone else? Anything about fundamental physics? That's fine. Although I skipped on that, I was just showing you how the sometimes work changes and progresses, and you have the same material, you can do fairly fundamental work like Aronoff-Bohm excitonic effect or quantum decoherence, and you can probably make practical devices. So, so I thought that would be interesting. All right, I see no questions left. You want to take over and say
yeah, I just want to thank you. Let's thank Igor for illuminating talk.
Thank you.
And if somebody wants to make any suggestions on how to improve this experience, please email it to me. I'll try to adjust the settings of the talks for the future. But for now, thank you, everybody. Stay safe. Have a good day.
And we'll see you in a week.
And we'll see you in a week. The next talk is by Lev Murach.
Yes, I will talk. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Goodbye.
We ask Daniel to send to all students, and of course, everyone who I invited today, you're welcome to join the next talks. I mean, I think it's a good experience with sitting at home, and we'll see you soon. Thanks.
Okay, bye. Bye,
thank
everybody.
You. Bye.